Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, March 31st, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
For more than 150 years, the United States has followed a simple idea. If you're born here, you're American, no matter who your parents are, no matter where they came from. That idea, birthright citizenship, codified in the 14th Amendment, is now under direct challenge at the U.S. Supreme Court. Oral arguments are set for tomorrow. The case involves an executive order signed by President Trump that would bar automatic citizenship for babies born in the United States if their parents are in this country, either illegally or temporarily. And that order, which has never gone into effect, raises questions at the core of national identity. Can the president end birthright citizenship? Does the 14th Amendment apply to undocumented immigrants? And the answers could reshape immigration policy, constitutional law, and the lives of millions of people. So today we're going to unpack the legal issues around this topic, as well as around the history of the 14th Amendment. We have a legal expert, we have a historian joining us, and of course, we want to hear from you. Do you think citizenship should be based on where you are born or inherited from your parents? And what do you think makes someone truly American? We want to hear from you. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube or Facebook, leave your comments in the chat. And Avi, this is something that a lot of Americans have sort of taken for granted.
Yes.
And now it's an issue up for debate before the U.S. Supreme Court.
And like you said, it goes to the core of American identity. Who are we? What makes us American? And we're a bit of an outlier compared to peer nations in Europe.
But we're
not an outlier compared to many nations in our hemisphere. Mm-hmm. This is an idea deeply rooted in New World identity. Mexico had birthright citizenship and so there's a lot of interesting history to go through here. A couple great experts right around the bend. Again, the question: do you think citizenship should be based on where you're born, or should it be inherited from your parents? And what makes us truly American? 888-477-9499. The email: studio2@whyy.org. But first,
trio.
Thank you.
So
your PICO bill.
Oh, goodness.
Could go up significantly next year. The company filed requests yesterday with the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission to raise electricity rates by 12.5%. That's a monthly hit of about $20 for the average PICO customer. They're also asking for a similar rate hike for suburban natural gas customers. Why now, you ask? PICO says it needs to invest in infrastructure upgrades, especially to keep electricity on during increasingly severe storms. And they say the longer they wait, the more expensive those upgrades will be. Now, as our own Susan Phillips reports, utilities like PICO make money and attract investment through infrastructure build-out. So this is a big part of their business model here.
Mm-hmm.
And some critics believe PICO's profit margins on these investments is far too high, which means too much of the money is going from ratepayers to shareholders.
Yeah, a lot of questions around PICO. People not very happy. I mean, the increased cost is on top of bills that have already been going up. I mean, we saw a $30 a month increase in 2025. Back in 2024, there was a $13 a month increase. And I mean, this is on top of the fact that, you know, your gas bills also went up. Your water bills also went up. And affordability is a major issue. And now, because PICO had a major increase in its profits, I think it jumped up more than 40% from $551 million in 2024 to $814 million in profit in 2025. So now workers say they want a piece of the pie.
Yep.
And there's talk that there could possibly be a strike by PICO workers if a deal isn't worked out with IBEW, their union. So there's a lot going on around PICO. There's a lot of backlash because they're making a lot of money and the customers are feeling stretched.
By the way, that contract that Cherry just referenced between IBEW Local 614 and PICO, It expires at midnight. So keep an eye on that.
1,000 workers there.
Keep an eye on that one. Story number two, Cherry.
Yeah, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker is making headlines this week after appearing on Meet the Press on Sunday in the interview with Kristen Welker when he was asked whether Democrats have made the mistake of shrinking their coalition by implementing these purity tests. He had this to say. Take a look, listen.
I'm proud of so many things that my Democratic colleagues are doing, but as a whole, our party has failed this moment. It's why I've called for new leadership in America. I've called for a generational renewal.
And by the way, he went on to say that the left-right divide is tearing the country apart. He says it is time for a new vision, new leadership, and a new moral imagination that brings people together. He says it's there, that he's tired and the country is tired of President Trump being the main character. By the way, Booker was on the show Sunday promoting his new book. It's titled Stand, as he runs for his third term in the U.S. Senate. He recently got married to his wife, Alexis, and he is now seen as a potential candidate for president in 2028, something he has said he is not ruling out. Sounds pretty familiar, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, you're talking about Governor Shapiro?
Yeah.
Well, this is the time of year where everyone's feeling out, not ruling out. So not
Governor, California Governor Gavin Newsom yeah, also.
Everyone's got books. This is the circuit right now.
Yeah.
By the way, speaking of the circuit, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker is going to be on Studio 2 tomorrow at noon. So we can ask him some questions and you can as well tune in for that. But look, Booker's an interesting character, mm-hmm. whether or not he runs for president. He's saying don't make Trump the main character. But can you do that and get through a Democratic primary where a lot of the base is really, really mad about the changes President Trump is implementing in this country, including the topic we're talking about today, birthright citizenship, right? So can you run a campaign that is based on ideas and policy proposals and hope and sort of earn the trust of Democratic voters? I think that's an open question.
That is definitely an open question, because a lot of people have said that Booker is just too nice. They want somebody who's scrappy,
right,
who's going to get in there and get a little bloody if necessary. Why people have been sort of pointing to Gavin Newsom, who was willing to get dirty and in the weeds with President Donald Trump. So the question is what kind of leadership they want.
Yeah.
I know that people have been talking about this generational thing. The Senate's old and all that. And there needs to be this generational shift, not just in Democratic politics, but also Republican politics.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of questions and arguments being made.
Right.
On
now,
both
the
sides
devil's
of the
advocate argument here would be that generally what people want is the opposite of what they have in American politics.
Yeah.
And so if you want to be the opposite of Donald Trump, who is bombastic and self-aggrandizing and attention getting, then maybe you need to be a nice guy. Right. So I don't know. I don't have the answer to this. Political strategists spend 24/7 thinking about these things. But, you know, what Booker is testing here is that theory, I think, that you need to be sort of an anti-Trump in the way you present yourself, but not necessarily anti-Trump as much in your rhetoric or in your sort of policy prescriptions.
Yeah. So, looking forward to that conversation. By the way, if you have questions for Senator Booker, studio2@whyy.org.
Great plug, Sherry.
Yeah, there you
great
go.
Plug.
He'll be here tomorrow.
By the way, you loving this weather today?
I am. I didn't even wear a jacket.
The weather is beautiful. The air is filled with the sounds of spring, children laughing, birds chirping.
Chirp, chirp.
And of course, two South Philadelphia ice cream trucks engaged in what appears to be a turf war.
Uh-oh.
Al, hit it.
It's a turf war.
Wait for it. Oh, man, your ears are ringing, right?
Oh, my goodness.
That chilling video was posted to Philly Reddit by a user named Tick Tick Boom. It shows two ice cream trucks on a corner in South Philadelphia, just about 30 feet from one another, blasting competing jingles at one another. And of course, now you and I must suffer. I don't know exactly what happened here, but in the Reddit thread, a couple commenters said that they've seen these competing trucks in South Philly and believe there is some sort of dispute between them, which I'm not surprised by, because the ice cream truck game in South Philly, it's fierce. I mean, you need sharp elbows. You apparently need a very robust sound system. So maybe there's some sort of drama going on in South
Philly.
Because
the kids hear that, Jingle Man, they run, they come running outside.
Well, they run around the other way if they hear the two at the same time. It's
but
like
you
horror
know what?
Music.
Somebody wrote in the comments, we need a Meek verse over that. I'm here for a good beef, you know, and Philly's filled with them. You had the Ali versus Frazier. You have Pat versus Geno's. And if you take it all the way back, Alexander Hamilton versus Aaron Burr. I mean, we are.
It's a beef city.
This is a beef city.
It's a beef city.
Let's
through
do
and
it.
Through. Through and through. Do you think, I have a question for you.
Uh-huh.
Do you think there is like a code of ethics or a code of conduct within the ice cream truck community?
I think they probably, you know, drew some blocks. You know how Philly is very territorial?
Yeah, so, and someone stepped over the line here.
They're like, look, you know, this is too early in the season. We're not It probably was a chilly day, too. They're like, we got to go wherever the money is.
Absolutely. I this made me realize that at one of the big parks that we hang out at, it does seem like the trucks like trade turns.
Yeah.
And so somebody, I think someone wasn't trading.
Yeah.
That would be my guess.
Yeah.
Also, by the way, that's the worst sound I've ever heard in my entire
life. The two sounds.
It's horrifying. It's like the two jingles on top of each other.
Mr.
Made
Softy
me shiver.
Versus who? I don't know.
Yeah. Someone else. We'll be right back. Y'all know.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The Supreme Court hears oral arguments tomorrow in a landmark case testing what determines citizenship in this country. In 1868, the 14th Amendment enshrined birthright citizenship into the Constitution, granting almost any child born in the U.S. automatic citizenship.
But in an executive order last year, President Trump asserted his authority to override that amendment and deny citizenship to children born to undocumented immigrants and temporary residents. Now that executive order is before the Supreme Court in a case called Trump v. Barbara.
This hour, we're talking about the momentous decision before the court, the history of the 14th Amendment, how it shaped America, and the legal challenges along the way. And we've got two great guests with us to break it all down. Carly Goodman is Assistant Professor of History at Rutgers University Camden and the author of Dreamland, America's Immigration Lottery in an Age of Restriction. Professor Goodman, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
We also have Anil Callahan, Professor of Law at Drexel University. Professor Callahan, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks to you.
Yes, and to you, our listeners on the road at home or elsewhere, our questions of the day. Do you think citizenship should be based on where you are born, or should it be inherited from parents? Also, what do you think makes us truly American? You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on Facebook or YouTube, put your comments in the chat.
George says, read the Constitution. That is why our founders and forefathers created it. Okay. So we will do that, George, in a second. But first, Carly, I am a little curious. This might be a strange place to start. But before the 14th Amendment, lots of people immigrated to this country. How did they become citizens? What was the, was there a system? Was it sort of a free-for-all? How did it work?
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for dedicating this hour to such an important topic. This is really foundational. It might be one of the most important Supreme Court cases, you know, of our lifetimes, and will really have important consequences for the people of Philadelphia and beyond. So before the 14th Amendment, there are sort of two ways to become a citizen, be born here or naturalize as a citizen. And I think one thing that I would point to is this 1790 naturalization law that really made naturalization, which is the process of becoming a citizen, you know, quite an easy one for free white persons of good moral character. And so the founders, that founding era, they really intended for immigrants who they imagined to be largely European to be able to come to the United States, join in this diverse American polity, and become Americans with relative ease after just a short time of residency. Also, of course, at the same time that immigrants were coming and naturalizing as citizens, people were having babies, and those babies were pretty much presumed to be American citizens. Would you agree with that, Anil, that characterization? I know that you're our constitutional legal scholar. So anything that has to do with laws, I don't want people to be emailing me about laws or speaking Latin or anything like that. So I just want to double check with
was
you.
Was that how it worked?
Yeah. I mean, that's right. And in terms of birthright citizenship, the English rule was quite clear going back to the 17th century, a case called Calvin's case, which provided that people who were born within the king's dominion became subjects of the king, even if their parents were coming through temporarily. That was clear. And then when the United States became independent, the first the individual states, as a matter of common law, became they received this common law tradition, mm-hmm. and throughout the period leading up to the 14th Amendment, this was clear. It was clear that this was the rule,
So
with very limited exceptions, which we can talk about.
And so, you know, part of the way a lot of people understand the 14th Amendment, there was in time leading up to that, there was a period called Reconstruction, post-Civil War, where you have a lot of freed African Americans or freed Black people who were living in the United States, and they were not considered citizens. Is that correct, Anil? And why could you talk about what was happening with these individual people and why the folks decided, you know what, we're going to have the 14th Amendment and we're going to codify this in this way?
So the key moment to understand is the Dred Scott decision from before the Civil War, right? Mm-hmm. Which provided that people of that Black people could not become citizens, even if they were freed, right? And so that if they were sort of enslaved people in one state and had become moved to another and were freed, that in fact even earlier than that, the Fugitive Slave Act had required states to return them, right? And I will defer to Carly on history, just as she's saying with me into law, but Dred Scott effectively established this principle that of course prompted the Civil War, mm-hmm. and then so after the Civil War, Congress enacted the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which provided that all persons born in the United States and not subject to any foreign power, excluding, and the phrase they used was Indians not taxed, are hereby declared to be citizens. And Andrew Johnson, who had become president after Lincoln was assassinated, vetoed that. The law became law after Congress overrode that veto. But to put that principle on a stronger constitutional footing, Congress proposed the 14th Amendment, sent it to the states for ratification.
So they made a law and then they kind of firmed it up with the 14th Amendment, but that's clearly the trajectory
that was
always going on.
And Dred Scott is the key moment, right? Because of course, Dred Scott is sort of, as a formal matter, remains the Supreme Court decision that is controlling even as the war has proceeded.
And Carly, I want you to kind of give us some political context because they could have chosen to not choose birthright citizenship. They could have chosen another method of transforming people who immigrated to this country or were born in this country, another way of making them citizens. Why did they choose this as the method for the 14th Amendment?
Okay, great question. I want to spend even a little bit more time on Dred Scott and go back to 1857 because I really think this helps set things up to understand the sectional crisis that was happening in the United States at the time. And just to understand also what a horror this decision was by Judge Taney, right? That he said that Black men have no rights a white man is bound to respect, right? And In a way, this was overturning people's citizenship. It was taking people's who had been born free, Black people. It said, no, you don't have citizenship anymore. And in fact, you know, you don't have the basis to have rights. And so Frederick Douglass gives a big speech at this time. And he says that although this is a really dark moment, he's also overjoyed because the abolitionist movement had been building and building and building, you know, from the 1830s, William Lloyd Garrison, to the 1850s, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which had essentially made slavery a national institution that required people to enforce the ownership of human beings, even in places like Boston and Philadelphia, right, that this was really galvanizing for people because people throughout the country could see in their own backyards what slavery meant. And so with the Dred Scott decision, I think the pro-slavery forces perhaps thought this was settling an issue, but it was actually breaking it wide open. Abolitionists had like given us an interpretation of the Declaration of Independence that really highlighted liberty and equality as essential founding values, what it means to be American, right? We don't just celebrate being separate from England and having separated ourselves from an empire. We celebrate that this is what the founders intended and laid out: all men are created equal. And so heading into the Civil War, which was fought about slavery, that war wasn't necessarily about emancipation at its outset, but over the course of fighting and with the influence of abolitionists shaping Lincoln's thinking, it became an emancipationist war, a war for emancipation. So then the question becomes, what does that mean, yeah, right? Who gets to be an American? Who has rights? How do you make emancipation real? And I think with the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which Congress passed, a radical Republican Congress passed, that was happening simultaneously as some of these Southern states were passing black codes and stripping away people's rights. Mm. And so I think to your framing there, which I think is just right, this needed to be cemented through a constitutional amendment.
And then, so let's get to the 14th Amendment here. It begins, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Okay, so That goes through 1868. 30 years later, there's a landmark case, right, Anil, about what exactly this means with respect to the children of people who have immigrated here. So let's get to that case and why it's so important today.
Yeah, so this case, 1898, Wong Kim Ark, is foundational. And what it involved was the U.S.-born son of a Chinese immigrant who was lawfully in San Francisco, who had been denied reentry. You know, the question at that time is that, Chinese, the individual is denied reentry, this is a time of Chinese exclusion, right? Mm-hmm. People, the parents of children who were born in the United States of Chinese descent could not naturalize and become citizens,
right,
under the exclusion regime, but under the one that Carly mentioned, actually, going back to 1790.
But what about their children?
Right. So then the Supreme Court holds and really reaffirms and ratifies the rule that had been understood to be prevailing before the Civil War, before the 14th Amendment, that it referred to, in fact, as the ancient and fundamental rule. Right, that citizenship within the birth of the territory, including children of resident non-citizens, are citizens of the United States at birth.
Right? I just want to focus on something there, what you're saying. You said it was reaffirming, but it wasn't like a novel interpretation.
No.
It wasn't like they were just summoning this interpretation of the 14th Amendment. And it's not even like the 14th Amendment was really what was establishing that, because there was a precedent even before that, that the children of people who come to this country were citizens of this country.
That's
Do I have that right?
That's right.
Okay.
Going back to English common law, this case, Calvin's case from 1608, before the Civil War, common law cases at the state level, there was a case by John Marshall, the Schooner Exchange from 1812, I believe, and it made very clear, right? And of course, reinforced by the text of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment doesn't talk about the parents. It talks about all persons born in the United States.
And this is the question that kept rising in my mind, because what did lawmakers in 1868 actually mean when they said by the words subject to the jurisdiction thereof? Like, who was excluded from this phrase, so that we really understand the differences that are being argued here? I know.
Yeah. So Professor Akhil Amar from Yale Law School has put this, I think, in a very vivid way. If you're born under the flag of the United States, you are a citizen. The exceptions were limited exceptions for people who effectively are born under other sovereigns, who are sort of, you know, in enclaves in the United States. If they're the children of diplomats who have immunity, right? Or a foreign head of state who is visiting. If there are foreign public ships in harbors. Mm-hmm. Or if there are children of enemy forces who are occupying U.S. territory, right? Which is a particularly, you know, of course, there's those forces are effectively controlling their own sort of sovereign peace. You know, U.S. law wouldn't run to those areas. That all comes from the English tradition. The one innovation, if you want to call it that, in the United States has to do with Indian tribes. Mm-hmm. And there's a case of prior to Wong Kim Ark, Elk versus Wilkins, which faced this question about what about individuals who were born to members of Indian tribes. And Elk versus Wilkins sort of extended this exception to that situation because that also involved a sort of relationship, distinctive relationships between sovereigns, right? We don't think about it this way today, but, you know, in the 19th century, the notion that Indian tribes were distinct and separate sovereigns was stronger than it was today. The civil and criminal laws wouldn't run to Native Americans in tribes.
Yeah. And so just to be clear, like and folks were subject to everybody except the individuals that you talked about. I mean, even if you're undocumented, even if you're here temporarily, these individuals are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, right? They have to follow the laws here.
That's
correct?
Right. That's right. They're not immune from civil or criminal laws that were applying to them. And in fact, I think this was clearly understood when it was being debated, when the 14th Amendment was being debated, there were questions about whether it would extend to these groups. And the debate was really more about whether that was a good idea or a bad idea, mm-hmm. not about whether, you know, the opponents of the 14th Amendment or the skeptics, they understood exactly that this was the case, that it would in fact extend birthright citizenship.
And we're worried about that.
Yes.
Openly.
They were worried about it, but there was no question about interpreting it differently.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Our question this hour, do you think citizenship should be based on where you're born? Should it be inherited from parents? 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're streaming on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. Kamau says, I understand and believe the Constitution to be a living document, but it's not to be reevaluated to push a racist agenda. Instead, it should be revisited to promote more inclusion and diversity, because that is where the nation is going. So the other question that I have sort of as we talk about this legal conversation, Carly, is how this evolution of birthright citizenship and the codifying and the reaffirmation of it just changes the way Americans see themselves and how it changes how prospective immigrants see America and how it changes immigration patterns to America. There's a lot there in that question, but take a bite out of whatever section you want. Like how does this change the American immigration story?
A phrase has come to my mind, which is that birthright citizenship is settled, but the question of who can be an American has never been, right? Mm. And so this whole thing, the Supreme Court, what we're doing here, it seems kind of absurd, I think, to people who study this history, because for 130 years, we know what birthright citizenship, we know what subject to the jurisdiction thereof really looks like. And yet, I think we do have this ongoing unfinished project, I think, as our caller mentioned, of sort of trying to figure out what does it mean to be an American? How are we going to define equality and liberty and things like this? And that this is something that we as a people and a democracy have to constantly be contesting and fighting about. Now, immigration, I think, is a really important part of the history of the United States. It's a very important part of like the settlement of the United States. It's part of a lot of our families' own histories, right? And birthright citizenship has enabled the sort of marginal status of non-citizens to be time limited, right? That it ends with the generation of the person who arrives who's not a citizen. If when children are born as citizens, they are, you know, profoundly embedded in the society and they are participants in our democracy and they get to decide what does freedom look like? What does it mean to be an American? And so I think that has been very important over the years in making immigration to this country, you know, an attractive idea.
Well, because we conceptualize people came here for opportunity, you know, sort of like the streets paved with gold sort of story that we tell ourselves, right? And I'm curious, of course, economic opportunity, I'm sure, is a big part of why people, generally immigrated to this country, but also just the idea that this is a place where people believe your children will belong. Like, I know that this is a totally unquantifiable question, but like, how big a factor do you think that has played in inspiring people to want to come to this country?
I think, like, to me, in the United States, the circumstances of a person's birth are not supposed to define and curtail and limit their opportunities in life, right? Mm-hmm. That at its best, the idea of this place is a place where people can come and put down roots and build communities and use their talents and live lives of joy and perhaps expand what we think of when we think of American freedom, right? That, and maybe this is not the mainstream view, but I don't know. It feels very familiar to me that this is like the story that we tell about the United States and that the United States has to at least aspire to meaning something, to enacting values that we share in common, that we have to believe in things like equality, democracy, liberty, right?
Yeah. By the way, I want to bring in a caller because our question of the day is, do you think citizenship should be based on where you're born or inherited from parents? And what do you think makes someone truly American? Trish from Newport, Delaware is on the line. Trish, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. My comment is that it's an excellent way to take health care away from newborns if they turn this around.
Yeah.
Because the parents would have to go out and prove that they were Americans in order for their kid to get health care and at crucial times.
Yeah. Thank you. Trish from Newport, Delaware. By the way, you can participate in the conversation. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Anil, I want to ask you, because what Carly is talking about, this myth that we have around America, like, bring everybody here, we're all going to be equal. This idea that we have about what America is versus the reality of what America is. And legally, we've seen sort of this debate bubble up every so often. And usually it's around people who are not white. And can you sort of walk us through, because this debate sort of happens, it's political, it's racial, it can be racist. Can you help us put this in context?
Yeah, and I think it's all of those things. And it's also very contemporary in its origins. I mean, this is something I think is worth lingering upon. Wong Kim Ark established, reinforced, codified a principle that had already been present and in the pre-Civil War period. And then over the course of the 20th century, everybody gets on board, right? There's a dissent in the case itself, but then, you know, for the next 80 years, there's continuing additional cases in the Supreme Court. Congress codifies this into legislation based on a settled understanding. The executive branch itself, which had litigated against this in Wong Kim Ark itself, takes positions that continue to reinforce the solidity of this principle. And then it's only really in the 70s and 80s when the backlash to immigration, you know, the emerging, you know, broadening in the 60s, with the 65 Immigration Act and the rise of immigration restrictionists as a movement, that you start to see the development of the anti-birthright citizenship position, right? It's framed in historical terms, but it's not really a sort of let's go back to historical principles. It's entirely an artifact of the contemporary period,
right,
with all of the things that you're describing about sort of the...
Because they're not pointing back and say, let's do it the way we used to do it.
No, because I mean, they are
not how we used to do it.
No, they're sort of, they do cherry pick historical positions to try and sort of make a clever argument about history. But it's entirely, all of the arguments that are being made are emerging now, right? Mm-hmm. There was like a little bit of a scholarly sort of position taken by a couple of outlier scholars in the 80s around this time, right, that immigration restrictionism, you know, which Carly has written about extensively, came to the fore. And then they were roundly rejected by all expert voices.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk more about that on the other side of this break, and also maybe get in a little bit into the global context as well. Mm-hmm. We'd love to hear from you. Studio2@whyy.org, 888-477-9499. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, the Supreme Court will hear arguments tomorrow on the legality of President Trump's executive order seeking to end birthright citizenship. So today, we're talking about the history of the 14th Amendment and the current debate around it.
Yes, and with us in studio this hour, we have Carly Goodman, Assistant Professor of History at Rutgers University, Camden, and the author of Dreamland, America's Immigration Lottery in the Age of Restriction, and Anil Kalhan, Professor of Law at Drexel University.
And we want to hear from you, our listeners. Do you think citizenship should be based on where you're born? Should it be inherited from parents? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook, how you doing? Drop a comment in the chat. I like this question from Jesse in East Passyunk because it goes to what you were just talking about, Anil, before the break, the sort of rising backlash against global migration. And it's not just happening in the U.S. There's people moving all over the globe in each and every direction, and that really has intensified over the last, maybe let's say, 100 years or so. So Jesse asks, I'm curious to know if your guests know of any other countries that have or had the born under the flag, you're a citizen philosophy in early constitutions. How did they change with a more globalized world? So what's happening in this country, the challenge to this law, is it part of a pattern?
I mean, as you said at the outset of our conversation, in the Western Hemisphere, the pattern is a very solid commitment, yeah. Right? There have been other countries that have, you know, more qualified positions on birthright citizenship. And the United Kingdom is one example. In the early 1980s, they sort of pulled back on their own history, right? Because, of course, our
principles. We got it from them.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So they pulled back on that. And it caused a lot of disruption and turmoil. I mean, you know, there were longtime residents from the Caribbean and their UK-born children who then suddenly were in the position, right, to the point of your caller earlier, that they couldn't prove their nationality, then they were sort of subject to circumstances where they lose access to jobs, to housing, other social service benefits, and face the risk of deportation, right? The Dominican Republic is another example.
That's the one I was thinking
quite
of.
Quite prominently, yeah. Right, where retroactively, mm-hmm. A couple hundred thousand individuals of Haitian descent had their citizenship taken away. And, you know, this was, I think, the largest statelessness population in the Western Hemisphere in its history. And, you know, and that's the other thing that sort of is the specter here. When this happens, the risk of statelessness mm-hmm. becomes very prominent,
yeah.
Right? It's not only about the loss of access to status and benefits in your own country, but it may be that you don't actually have access to citizenship and nationality anywhere else.
Depending yeah. where you come from.
Yeah.
Rob Formica on YouTube says, I think most Americans would support restricting birthright citizenship to the children of permanent residents. That's the law in most countries, but that's not what the Constitution says. And so that goes to Carly. I mean, you know, we said this at the outset, and we've just talked about this, that, you know, the United States and many of the countries in this hemisphere are outliers when we look at other countries globally on how we bring in citizens, right? We say birthright citizenship here. How unique is this? And people don't realize there are other options. It's a lot harder to become citizens in many, many, many other countries, Carly.
You do not want to be in a situation where Judge Taney can strip you of your citizenship,
yeah.
Right? Like leaving this up to the whims of bureaucrats and administrators and judges is a recipe for a deeply unequal society, a society that resembles 1857 in the United States, where slavery was essentially nationalized, right? I don't know if that's convincing to you from a perspective of, like, could you put yourself in the shoes of, but I think anything that sort of loosens our shared commitment to this value is really dangerous for people,
yeah.
And would exacerbate already existing, you know, inequalities in our society.
Yeah, and Anil, I don't know if you can comment on that, because there are a lot of different ways that you can become you know, I guess a state or a country can choose to allow people to become citizens. And we are outliers. If you look at the rest of the world, there are not a lot of countries where you become citizen just based on where you're born.
The alternative would open a Pandora's box, though. I mean, there's something about having, I mean, yeah, first of all, the Constitution, if you want to change the clear constitutional provision, right, that ordinarily you would think of as requiring a constitutional amendment, right? And of course, that's not the process that's being followed here. But if you were to think about this in terms of not what the text of the 14th Amendment says in terms of the persons born, mm-hmm. But in terms of the status of their parents, that becomes you have a whole host of complicated inquiries, right? Do you focus on just the mother, just the father? Do they have to have both parents have that status? Does the government need to inquire about the intention of the parents? Why is the kid responsible for that when they're born here? What if it's uncertain, right? What if their parentage is uncertain, right? There's all kinds of complicated questions that might arise.
And it just...
And well, in terms of administrability. Yeah.
And I would just add, we have seen in recent, the last year, what it looks like to illegalize people, yes. right? To strip away their legal status. We have seen this over and over again, you know, taking TPS status away from people, denying people's, you know, asylum claims, that this idea that legal status is just sort of a something that you have or something that you are is completely divorced from the reality, which is that it's quite dynamic. And the state has a lot of power to sort of decide, okay, you're illegal, or your temporary visa means that, you know, your child is not born a citizen. So that's a tremendous power to be able to have. And I think one that, you know, a lot of us object to, right? Those people who are going out into the streets to protest against ICE recognize that this is a gross abuse of power against people who are just our neighbors and are just living here. And so if you were to change the rules and create a different system by which you could apply for citizenship as though it was a privilege rather than a right, you would open up, you know, there would be tremendous consequences. Yeah.
So we want to make sure we have a little time to get to the case itself and how it might be adjudicated. Let me bring in a caller first. This is Pam from Cherry Hill on line 3. Hey, Pam, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Thanks for having this important topic on, by the way. Mm-hmm. So my question is, what is to stop if this case is decided in favor, you know, taking away birthright citizenship, what is to stop them from just one tier of individuals? What's to stop them from saying, well, we don't want this particular group here, and we are going to go back, like, you know, 50 years, 100 years, or what if we don't want this particular religion in this country?
Thank you, Pam.
That's the Pandora's box right there.
So, So I guess it's maybe worth going over the specifics of this case, because it is a specific executive order, Anil, that would challenge the citizenship status of children born to people who are in this country undocumented or who are here temporarily. So in the scenario where the Trump administration wins outright, and most folks don't expect that, but in that scenario, then you're only talking about this group right now. But would there be other constitutional backstops against potentially expanding that group in the future to include other people?
I mean, the logic of that kind of decision would necessarily it could not be limited to the groups in this executive order.
Yeah.
It just could not be, right? Because if what you're saying is that this was never correctly the right principle under the 14th Amendment at all, it really opens the door to the possibility of retroactively questioning the citizenship of people who were born going back as far as you might think.
Now, to be clear, though, there would have to be another executive order or piece of legislation that would seek to remove that citizenship, though, right?
Yes, okay. But of course, we also have an administration that posts on social media that they are looking forward to the removal of 100 million people.
Yeah, and that's what makes the legal questions I have, Anil, is this. I mean, how unusual is it that someone tries to go against an amendment to the U.S. Constitution using an executive order? This to me is talking about executive power, and I don't know what precedent this president is using to extend his power to this.
I mean, in this presidency, it's not unusual. I mean, there's any number of examples where this presidency is pushing the envelope on settled constitutional understandings. And but this is particularly brazen given how settled this principle is.
Right. Yeah. And I guess my follow up, the court, has there been any indication, if we think about the makeup of the court, we would assume that the three liberal justices would sort of uphold the legal precedent when it comes to birthright citizenship. Is there any indication about how the other six justices are leaning?
I mean, not directly. I mean, we have tea leaves. We'll have, of course, a better sense after the argument. But there's a couple things I would point to. One is that conservative legal and legal academic opinion is divided on this question, right? Mm-hmm. I think, like I said, the overwhelming weight of expert opinion for many, many years has been in favor of the consensus in favor of birthright citizenship. And most originalist scholars still, I think, favor that view. The people who have started to speak to this in support of the administration's position have done so really only recently. So it's not clear that that will, and of course they've gained some head of steam in support of the Trump administration, but I don't know that necessarily that's a good indicator of how some of the conservative justices
On that point, because like we have a comment here and a question, I think, so some people are wondering, I think just like by taking the case, are they signaling something, right? So Ken says, mm-hmm. on what legal argument/basis did the Supreme Court decide to take this case? Well, my sort of literal answer to that would be there was an executive order, there was a challenge to it, and the Supreme Court can hear any challenge it wants as long as it makes it to its doorstep. Is there any meaning to the fact that they took this case?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's the lower courts have consistently ruled against the Trump administration, but I think as long as you don't have a Supreme Court decision on the merits squarely, there's a cloud over the issue,
right?
In some ways, right? And so that's
they might try to clear the cloud, or they could, and then this gets to another part of this, right? There is an off-ramp here that entails them not actually ruling on the 14th Amendment.
That's right.
Because there is another law, I think it's passed in 1952, mm-hmm.
That's right.
That reaffirms this birthright citizenship principle. And they could say, we're not going to look at the 14th Amendment. We're just going to say, well, there's already a law on the books. And if you want to change that law, Congress, go ahead and change that law. And then we can talk about the 14th Amendment. Am I getting that part right?
Yeah,
there.
That's okay. Right. Both in 1940 and in 1952, okay. Congress enacted a statute that effectively codified the settled understanding.
Right.
Right. So, and it would go against the conservative approach, the textualist approach to interpreting statutes, to read that statute, I think, in a way that is inconsistent with that settled understanding.
Right.
Yeah. And I want to bring in a caller because this was my question as we only have four more minutes. Minnie from Westchester's on the line. Minnie, you're on Studio 2. If you could quickly give your question or comment.
My question is, if the Supreme Court upholds this in President Trump's favor, does that mean a future president can overturn any amendment he wants with an executive order? For example, say the Second Amendment. Could a future president just come and just strike that out? Thanks.
Thank you. That's Minnie from Westchester. And so, Anil, I really want to sort of talk about what the implications could be. And Avi kind of pointed to that. But I try to think about what the worst case scenario would be if this were to get through, if the Supreme Court were to rule in President Trump's favor. What are some of the tentacles that you see as far as repercussions? And Minnie had that question.
Yeah,
could that be one of them?
I think they're very significant. And they're significant in a way that extends beyond just the issue of citizenship or immigration-related issues. I mean, I would situate this in a different kind of context. The earlier proposals to attack birthright citizenship were either adopt a constitutional amendment, which is an onerous process, adopt a statute that might call into question, you know, that the interpretation we were just talking about.
An act of Congress.
Right. But this goes so beyond that, right? Because it's of a piece with the unilateral kinds of actions that the Trump administration has been taking with respect to DOGE and like firing, you know, just not spending money that has been appropriated by Congress or firing officials that have been in leading independent agencies. It's really sort of, if the Supreme Court were to validate that, they would be really just, and of course, they've already validated things like that in other contexts, they would be just putting a pretty big, you know, thumb on the scale in favor of unilateral executive action in a way that goes beyond what they've already validated in the way you're describing.
As we get ready to wrap, Carly, look, I'm just curious about the signal that all this sends to the rest of the world and to the next generation of people who might be thinking about coming to this country. you know, this is part and parcel of clearly a larger attempt to restrict immigration to this country. Do you think this idea that some people have when they immigrate to this country, do you think that idea is fading in the global community? Do you think it's sort of remains strong, like the allure of the American promise remains strong?
The Nativist Project has been incredibly successful at restricting immigration and making the idea of coming here a lot less appealing. To me, it's an even bigger question than what do potential immigrants around the world think? You know, when I think about the Civil War and how it was transformed into an emancipation, a war for emancipation, and the idea that, you know, Lincoln at Gettysburg said, this nation shall have a new birth of freedom, that, like, that is really the question that belongs to all of us, right? That we need to understand this moment as one in which we, the people, right? Not we, the citizens, not we, the white people, just to paraphrase Frederick Douglass, have to define what it means to be American. And I think what we're going to find is these attacks on immigrants and our immigrant neighbors, this effort to end birthright citizenship, it's not going to do anything to help our PICO bills, right? It doesn't make the rest of our citizenship stronger to erode the rights of others.
But do you think this redefinition, this attempted redefinition, is indeed succeeding at this moment? Or do you think this is a Waterloo, it'll be beat back?
I think that efforts like Asian exclusion, which lasted for decades, you know, have really persisted in our understandings of who gets to be a citizen, that echoes, you know, over the decades, and that laws and policies, they have power, but they also send signals about who belongs. It's up to us to sort of figure out how do we make a more inclusive United States.
That's the final word from Carly Goodman, Assistant Professor of History at Rutgers University, Camden, author of Dreamland, America's Immigration Lottery in an Age of Restriction. Thank you so much, Carly, for your time today. And thank you, Anil Kalhan, Professor of Law at Drexel University. Anil, appreciate the time.
And sorry to Mike from Upper Darby. We couldn't get to you. Hopefully you'll call back again. Got to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel Mae Bryan. Tina Calliquet and Al Banks engineered today's show. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.